vorhersehen. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Reading from the Bhagavatam. We're finishing off the first part of the Pillar Siksha, we're doing verses 28 to 29, and of course this concludes the studies on the 11th unit, and then we will do unit 12, and that will finish up the chapters from 30 to 33 of the third canto. So over the next month or so we'll finish up the third canto in module 1, and then we'll begin module 2, which is beginning from the fourth canto. So
okay, we'll storm.
So,
and that's a positive.
About halfway through.
Yes.
You're doing well.
So do we start the fourth canto afterwards? Or?
Yeah, we will.
Of course.
Alright, so let's look at chapter 28.
Let's go to the sixth.
What's that?
Let's go to the sixth
canto. Sixth
canto.
And then of course there's that's Bhakti Vaibhava. And then there's Bhakti Vedanta, which is the final six cantos. Now in this chapter, Lord Kapila explains that one should do his prescribed duties competently and be satisfied with gain obtained by God's grace. He's describing, you know, this is called Kapila's instruction on the execution of devotional service. One should cease performing conventional religious practices, accepting only what leads to salvation. He gives things, you know, the yama and the niyama, what should be done, what shouldn't be done, and he describes the Astanga yoga process here that coincides with the performance of bhakti, of various asanas, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, ultimately leading to samadhi. And of course that samadhi is fixing one's concentration upon the super soul, the Supreme Lord, devoting his mind to this and nothing else. So from that one gradually develops pure love for the Supreme Lord Hari and becomes filled with transcendental ecstasy, love, completely free from all material qualities, and completely liberated from the bodily conception of life, and this is the highest perfectional stage of yoga. And that such a yogi will see all the everything that exists as a manifestation of the different energies of the Lord. And sees all living entities, without distinction. So let's look at this. Who can say what is the link between this chapter and the previous chapter? some. In the previous chapter, Krishna began with a description of the consciousness, the behavior of liberated and conditioned souls. The conditioned souls, of course, can become liberated by executing pure devotional service.
Kapila explained
that actually by executing one's prescribed duties, one can become free from the contamination of matter. So, in essence, after describing the entanglements in material existence of the conditioned soul, then this chapter begins to describe how that conditioned soul can execute activities that bring them to the liberated state.
Yeah.
Keep in mind that with each chapter we're doing, it's good if you can have, you know, a little summary of it, even maybe just a few sentences, because, you know, one of your open book questions is to write an essay which is a summary on this whole section. That means, you know, chapters where we start. 25 to 29. So one of your essays is to write a summary. So it'd be about 300 words. So you just have a few sentences written on each chapter, and you do the same when we go into the 12th, the unit 12. So there's 4 chapters in that unit, and you just one your open-book question, which reminds me, I'll throw in the copy, because in your student books you don't have the open-book questions. Did? Yeah. Student book quote for unit 12?
What do I have?
Yeah, no. I've just prepared them the other day, so I'll photocopy them and give them to you. But one of them will be similar. So just keep that in mind. Try and get that summary sort of mentality as well as you're going through each chapter. Now we're going to look at the process of Stanga Yoga and Bhakti. You know, after about verse 11, this chapter describes that. I'll just ask, you know, have any students here ever done yoga, like Stanga Yoga? Stanga Yoga? Yeah? Can you show us a few of your moves?
Just the yoga I used to practice on the lower back.
Oh, okay.
So I was on painkiller and anti-inflammatories.
Yeah.
So it's not a good idea to have them for long, then they have caused the
That's right. Effects. Yeah.
So I didn't know they have to stop that and practice a little yoga.
And that helped?
Yeah, immediately if I would have. But at the end of the day, during the day, I'll come back again. So
okay.
And then I have to spend some time in the morning, then I'll be fine. But
right.
The day.
So as long as you did it every day, though?
Doing it in 2004 and 5.
Yeah.
But later on, I struggled a couple of
years. I've done some. Not a lot.
But at that point, I wouldn't know what to meditate upon.
Yeah.
Then I used to browse the books, and they say you have to meditate upon Omkar.
Omkar.
Yeah. And after reading Bhagavad Gita,
And Did you find any of it, any of the things that they may have recommended to be a bit foolish, or, you know, some parts of it? Did you find some parts of it to be, you know, impractical?
I think when people manipulate, take the country, well, it's just simple advancement that you do about the
foreign.
Yeah, well, I found that it deepened my concentration. After doing a class, then I go to work.
Yeah.
And my work's sort of very much a meditative sort of activity.
Yeah.
And it really deepened my ability
okay.
to do it.
Okay.
Yeah. Somehow it's just situated in your body.
Right.
Yeah, that was quite effective.
Any other
Yes. I do mostly just deep breathing when I can. I've had a lot of success, and I have had some sannyasis say to me, especially with the asthma, that deep breathing is very helpful.
Padmasana should cover even the Padmasana posture in sitting. You can pull up breathing techniques there.
Yes. Yeah, and I guess most of us dabbled in it a little bit without the real proper understanding of this Astanga yoga. But it's amazing how much you do get some benefit, even if you do even part of it properly.
I thought it was quite. Who would do it for health? Just physical health.
Physical health. And,
my parents do it every day, just plainly for physical health.
Yeah.
That's the general focus.
Yeah.
Just to pretty much stop there.
That's right. That, yeah, the, as far as the.
They're actually not interested in knowing anything else.
No.
So you heard people posting on the internet, like, they don't care about actually slander the spiritual side of it. Like, don't give it to me.
Yeah.
Don't want to know.
No, they want to know.
And they love doing yoga.
Yeah. some things, I remember my one yoga teacher told me that every day I had to, you know, brush my body down with like a bristle brush and drink a cup of seawater. Tried that once. I said to my parents, my yoga teachers asked me to drink a cup of seawater. And my parents go, you wouldn't want to be drinking that. That's not healthy. It's that polluted. Okay. But I never understood, and brushing the body down with a bristle brush. There's a few. We'll have a look at this. So, in chapter 26, Lord Kapila has taught about devotional service. What is that chapter called? There's 25, and this is also called the Word of Devotional Service. And chapter 26, I think he continued on as a word. Fundamental principles of material nature. It must be 25, I think.
Yeah.
25, devotional service. Then there's Sankhya, mixed with Bhakti in chapters 27 and 28 to some degree, or 26 and 27. So an analytical study of the elements, the spiritual and material elements of creation. And now he's beginning to speak about Astanga Yoga mixed with Bhakti. So we've had Sankhya mixed with Bhakti, and now Astanga mixed with Bhakti. And in the beginning he talked about Bhakti in its own, you know, right. So, first of all, there are several verses that describe the various rules for controlling the mind, such as, you know, non-violence, truthfulness, not stealing, not accepting more than necessary, celibacy, silence. You know, there's the yamas, and then there's the niyama. You see in verses 2, 3 and 4 there's some niyama.
Which chapter is that?
Chapter 28. So as described in verse 2, as long as one remains in the bodily concept of life, he may act according to the duties of social convention. But if one is elevated to the spiritual platform, he must simply serve the Supreme Lord. That is the real execution of Svadharma. Prabhupada mentions also in verse 3, that religious practice for economic development or satisfaction of the sense desires should be avoided. Religious practices should be executed only to gain freedom from the clutches of material nature. Here this is recommended as moksha dharma. So explaining this so that one can progressively advance towards the absolute truth. In verse 2, it says one should execute one's prescribed duties and avoid performing duties which are not allotted to him. One should be satisfied with as much gain as he achieves by the grace of the Lord. And one should worship the lotus feet of the spiritual master. Should cease performing conventional religious practices, should be attracted to those which lead to salvation. One should eat very frugally, should always remain secluded, like that. And verse 4, one should practice non-violence, truthfulness, avoid thieving, be satisfied with possessing as much as he needs, maintenance, abstain from sex life, perform austerity, be clean, study the Vedas, worship the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Form of the Lord, and observe silence up to there in verse 5. Describe the yama. And violence, truthfulness, not stealing, not accepting all the news, celibacy, silence, the yama. other items in the union. Do's and don'ts. Then there's verse 5. Steadiness by practicing different yogic postures, control of the breathing, the vital air, withdraw the senses from sense objects and thus concentrate the mind and the heart. So then he goes into the other aspects of Ashtanga Yoga. So there are 8 steps in Ashtanga Yoga mentioned in the purport, the first verse. Yama, Yama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Jnana and Samadhi. So really up to the first part of verse 5 is talking about Yama and Niyama, and then the rest of verse 5 starts to begin, just a brief summary of the other processes. Verses 5 to 7 in essence. Really, right up to text, say 13, describes all the different steps. So from verse 5 up to 13, the other 6 steps are described, and then of course from verse 13 to 33, that meditation, jhana. So asanas, of course, is the sitting postures. Pranayama is the controlling the breath. Pratyahara, withdrawal of the senses from the material objects. Drawing the senses to the heart using the mind. And Dharana is fixing the mind in one place through the prana. And then, of course, Jhanam is literally meditation. And then we meditate upon the Lord along with his pastimes. And then Samadhi is when that is, the mind is fixed, concentrated meditation. So all these things are described. In verse number 6, it describes the 6 circles or chakras of vital air circulation within the body. I've always sort of pictured this, some of the yogic practices that people do for health is something like what a plumber does. You have the these 6 concentrations of vital air, which are energy, in one sense, is distributed in different ways throughout the body. And if those chakras are somehow disturbed, the energy flow, in one sense, can be blocked, or it's almost like flushing out the plumbing to get the energy flowing where it should be, concentrated where it should be and flowing where it should be.
Are the chakras just material body or are they the spiritual body?
They're circles of vital air. No, these are, they're material. The situation. The Prabhupada mentioned in verse 6, one has to fix his mind and the circulation of the vital air and thus think of the transcendental pastimes of the Lord. So, you know, gradually by the asanas and the breathing process, it helps to fix the mind, control the mind, and to withdraw the senses. And then, you know, when the mind is controlled like that, the mind has to fix itself on the various chakra points in one place, so that's dharana, and gradually raise it, the mind, to the different chakras, and until it comes to the topmost chakra, actually the heart chakra, and one has to then go into meditation, because the goal of the fixing the mind is that one can meditate. The mind is not fixed, you can't meditate. So then when the mind is fixed, then we can meditate. So what is meditation? Meditation is meditation of the form of the Lord and the pastime. So this Swasti Samasina. Swasti Samasina. That's the one that most of a lot of devotees do, except that to do it properly, you put the soles of the feet between the two thighs and the ankles and you sit straight. You do that?
Is that Padmasana?
What's that?
Is that Padmasana?
Swasti Samasina.
Samasana.
You put the soles of the feet between the two thighs and ankles and sit straight. That's in verse 8. So you're saying that's also called Padma?
No, I'm asking.
It's saying here Swasti Samasina in verse 8. You know that one? Who'd like to do a demonstration? Yeah? Well,
they said an easy posture.
Come on.
Almost there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not easy, isn't it?
No,
Is everyone supposed to go to the
bathroom? Someone can float on there.
No, well, it's just
my wife can. My wife can do it.
I'm a bit sleepy and I'm in class, you do that, it keeps you awake. Yeah,
of course it does. It
hurts. That's not
good. So that's
how long do you have to sit like that?
Well, it's good to practice until you can do it comfortably all the time.
So Kapila Dev saying just to sit like that.
Yeah, then, well, these are just the beginning, you say. But when you can do that,
do it for 10,000 years.
It actually, it helps to keep the asanas keep your body in the right posture for breathing. Otherwise, you can sit in a slouch way, and the breathing is not correct. But when you do the proper asanas, they force you into the right position. So therefore, it helps one to concentrate his mind on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And it's a fact, as I say, I do that when I'm. It keeps you awake too. It's a.
Can you get up that fast?
So, Prabhupada mentions in verse 10 that one can purify the mind either by the breathing processes or by the chanting process. Just as one can purify gold by putting it in a fire and fanning it with a bellows. So, you see that in verse 6, fixing the vital air in the mind in one of the six circles of vital air circulation within the body, thus concentrating one's mind on the transcendental pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is called samadhi or samadhana of the mind. So, in essence, you know, verse 6 describes the process of dharana. Fixing the vital air in the mind in one of the six. So it helps you to come to the platform of samadhi, but it's describing the process of dharana.
How do you control the mind by breathing? Because the attraction between sense and sense subject is there, right? So how can the mind be?
Well, the mind is not engaged in these other activities that we described here. You know, the mind is not engaged in thinking of sex life. It's not, you know, engaged in, you know, thinking of violence or, you know, untruthfulness or thieving. The mind is absorbed in something. The mind is being refrained from thinking of all the other things. It's not thinking of eating too much or, you know, so many things. So, because your mind is thinking of, you know, how to execute these difficult asanas and breathing processes, and therefore it's not thinking of a whole lot of other bad things that it would usually think of. And the breathing and the postures help one to sit comfortably for long periods of time, because what happens is that ordinarily the senses, we heard in the previous chapter how the senses and the intelligence are connected, and that the intelligence helps the senses to discriminate. So the senses are perceiving various sense objects, and the intelligence is absorbed, bringing the consciousness into just meditating upon how to differentiate between good and bad aspects of the sense objects and how to engage the senses. So what happens is that now the intelligence is in one sense the function of sense gratification is empowered by the knowledge factor of the intelligence and by the vital ears. And so when we act for sense gratification, which means the mind and the senses are not controlled, the senses are empowered by the intelligence, so there's a knowledge factor, and by the vital ears. So we have to engage the intelligence in other activities and engage the vital ears in other activities. So the yoga process, in essence, is controlling that which empowers the senses for sense gratification. It's controlling the intelligence of the vital ears. So therefore, the sense gratification stops. It's no longer, and those the intelligence and the vital ears are then controlled, like that, through the breathing and the yoga processes. So therefore, it stops sense gratification, and that means the mind can be fixed. And when the mind is no longer fixed on sense gratification, the bodily concept of life, it can then begin to meditate on something else other than sense gratification, and that is the Supreme Lord. Verse 6 describes that dharana which brings you to samadhi, and then verse 7 expands a little bit on that goal of samadhi, of fixing, being fixed in thought on the Supreme Personality of God. And verse 8 again, the sitting postures, the asanas, the touch upon how to sit properly, and verse 9, the pranayama or the breathing processes that are described there. Again, verse 10, and 11 brings you back to how the pranayama brings you to pratyahara. The yogis who practice such breathing exercises are very soon freed from all mental disturbances. And by practicing the process of pranayama, one can eradicate the contamination of his psychological condition. And by concentrating the mind, one can become free from all sinful activities. So again, the psychological condition and the activities, are stopped because the intelligence, the mind, and the vital ears are controlled for other purposes. So in that way, the senses are restrained, so one can free oneself from material association, and then one can meditate. One can meditate upon the Supreme Lord. That's the beginning of meditation, or jhana.
Says that you come to pratyahara after all the yamni and pratyahara that you post step.
Yes.
So does that mean that after performing all these sitting postures, like the breathing exercise in the asanas, do they cause renunciation so that you can become detached from material objects? Or do you have to have some renunciation before so that you can actually engage in the process? Would you?
Yeah, there has to be some. There has to be a sense of detachment from the beginning. And know.
Like one should actually become frustrated from material life only then you take up this kind of yogic process.
Yes, and I think that's, you know, I think therefore in the next chapter, some of the questions that Devahuti asked expand upon that point of, you know, getting Lord Kapila to speak on the suffering, you know, the entanglement, the miseries, the difficulties of material existence, almost inspiring one to practice this, you know, come to the point of bhakti yoga either through Sankhya, you know, or Stanga, but, you know, gradually coming to bhakti. But there has to be some sense of detachment from the very beginning. But, you know, when we talk of withdrawal of the senses, that means there's detachment, there's a sense of detachment is there to take up the process. One has a sense of detachment and says, oh, I must withdraw my senses. So then the pranayama and the asana help one to literally withdraw the senses. They control the mechanism of the active senses. You know, that's what we're saying. As we, in the previous chapter, we saw that the mechanism of the senses is the intelligence and the vital ears. There's two things that empower the senses. So when we control the vital ears, we literally control the senses, the activities, and we control the intelligence, we also control, you know, the senses remaining. So pranayama, pratyahara, and the yama and the niyama, they are basically mechanically controlling the vital ear and the intelligence. And in that sense, you can mechanically withdraw the senses. Withdrawing the senses is not an easy thing. You know, if the senses are empowered, that they will act whether you want them to or not. You know, so literally disempowering the senses, you know, so that they withdraw is what they're doing.
It seems these days, say all the time, actually saying that the aim of yogi is to withdraw the senses. It's very offensive to say that to the yogis these days. They're doing yoga to enjoy better.
Yeah.
Even serious yogis are doing, they think they're doing Ashtanga yoga.
Yes.
When you say it's actually about renunciation of sense objects, that's very offensive. They can't say that.
That's
fine. They actually get very offended.
Yeah.
They have all the yogis.
I just don't want to get to that. But they're studying it a lot and they're practicing yoga. So
therefore, you know, we say if you don't withdraw the senses, how will you meditate? But they say we're not interested so much in meditation. They think that that's some religious issue that doesn't have to come into it.
I think they meditate. Well, they meditate on the breath. Then they go and enjoy it. It increases their ability to enjoy it.
Well, technically, you know, meditating on the breath is dharana. So there are eight processes. So if they consider dharana, which is all, you know, which is literally, if they consider dharana to be meditation, they're going against the very definition of dharana. And if they accept dharana as meditation, then when they get to jhana, what is it? If they're considering, that means when they get to the seventh step, they've got nothing to do. If they consider, we're meditating at the sixth step, so you have to ask them, well, what's the seventh step? And what's the eighth step for samadhi?
Also blends into one.
No, they actually have very technical explanations of what each step is. So they may label them as they please, but they actually have technical definitions of what they are. So meditation is different to, you know, meditation means you actually then fix your mind upon something, and dharana is where you're just coming to the point of controlling the mind through fixing it on the breathing and the sadhus, so that you can meditate upon something. So that, they're the technical definitions. So they're taking that as meditation itself. It's not. It's the preparatory step.
Yeah, they take money on business.
Yeah. But that's not meditation. That's just preparing the mind for meditation. Preparing the mind is, you know, fixing it on the breathing and the sound as well. So we get to verse 12, and then it describes how when the mind is perfectly purified by this practice of yoga, one can concentrate on the tip of the nose with half closed eyes and see the form of the Supreme Personality of God. Now verses 13 to 33 describe that form of the Lord, the Super Self. In these verses, Prabhupada mentions in several places different reasons why hearing and chanting is actually superior to fixing the mind on the pastimes of the Lord. So for instance, verse 19, it's easier. Hearing and chanting is actually easier than fixing the mind on the pastimes of the Lord. Because verse 19, it says, thus always immersed in devotional service, the yogi visualizes the Lord standing, moving, lying down, or sitting within him, for the pastimes of the Supreme Lord are always beautiful and attractive. That's a very important verse, that one. You know, that the Lord is standing, moving, lying down, or sitting within him. So there's verse 19. I'll come back to that. So the Lord's actually doing different things at different times. Even a child can hear and derive the benefit of meditating on the pastimes of the Lord simply by listening to a reading from the Bhagavad Gita. So, you know, we have experience even currently. Children can sit and hear and in a very easy way they can fix their mind upon the Srimad Bhagavatam. Very easy for them. But if you ask those same children to meditate upon the pastimes of the Lord for that same amount of time, it's in fact impossible. Srila Prabhupada also describes that in verse 26. the Lord's form can either be meditated upon in the mind or placed in a temple in the form of a statue decorated in such a way that everyone can contemplate it. So temple worship is meant for people who are not so advanced that they can meditate upon the form of the Lord. They can just come and, you know, people, you see them, or they come in, they just stand there in front of the deity for, you know, ages, and they just fix, you know, and the time that they do that, people who practice yoga can't do that. They can't stand there, you know, as long with their mind fixed upon the Lord as what people just come in off the streets and they'll just stand before the deities and they can do what the yogis can't do. Very easily. There's no effort at all. So, so hearing and seeing the deities as well. And of course, as Prabhupada says, there's no difference between directly seeing the form of the Lord and seeing the deity. Now,
in reference to this previous letter, somewhere in the second canto, my memory is correct, Prabhupada said that yoga is for those who do not have the bhakti to be able to touch the deity. So therefore they have to go through this long process to purify themselves before they can see the Lord.
Yeah.
Whereas deity worship is for those who have that already, that little bit of bhakti.
Yeah.
And who therefore have the what do you say, the right to touch the Lord directly in the deity worship.
That's right. Yeah.
So it seems sort of contradictory that here.
Not really, because the temple deities, as you heard Prabhupada say this morning and yesterday on the same tape, he was saying that people who are fortunate to come to the Krishna consciousness movement, you know, they can see the deities and chant and so many things. And Krishna said, Krishna consciousness, you have to be fortunate. And Prabhupada said, no, you know, yes. You know, it's for the fortunate. So fortunate people, there's some egalitarian decree, they can take advantage, they've done some, you know, particularly meritorious piety in previous lives, associated with devotional service. But he said, even if that's not there, anyone can take advantage of it. So that means that anyone, that they may not have any advancement, any piety, any egalitarian decree, but if they decide, let me just take advantage of it, and just, they can do that as well. So therefore, yes, you can say that deity worship. So that means for those who are regularly coming to the temple and seeing the deity, you would have to say that they're more advanced than the yogis who are not able to do that. And they will have to purify themselves by the yoga process to come to that platform to be able to regularly come and see and be attached to the deities. But for others who come in and without any piety or a gaudiya creedy, they can also, if they decide, yes, I would like to go and see what they're doing in there, and they can stand and look at the deities and see how beautiful, they can take the same full advantage with no pious credit, no qualification whatsoever, therefore, and they can also hear and chant, and therefore they can come into a kirtan with no qualification for the previous lives at all, and they can chant and hear. So therefore it's very easy. But for those who are accustomed to do it, you would have to say that they're, you know, above the yogis. Therefore what you generally see is that if people have some good stock of the gyanas, creedy and piety associated with devotional service and what have you in their previous lifetimes, that when they come to Krishna consciousness and they may take advantage of the facility in ISKCON for meditating upon the Lord and hearing the chant, they find it quite easy. Others who don't have that stock of piety can also come in, and it's also just as easy for them, but because they're not accustomed to it, it's difficult for them to maintain that activity. honesty. So, you know, usually you see that's a good sign of someone who's perhaps got a good stock of piety, emotional piety in the previous life, that when they come along to Krishna consciousness, they can do the easy process and continue effortlessly. Where the person comes along and it's easy for them, but they find it hard to continue, you know, then they may be lacking some piety, you know, from previous lifetime. But if they decide to do it, they can, if they want to, because it is so easy. But because they may be habituated to impious activities, that may make it difficult. Now, Prabhupada makes another point in the verse 26 that, you know, the advantageous position of a yogi is that he can sit anywhere in a solitary place and meditate upon the form of the Lord. A less advanced person, however, has to go to the temple, and as long as he does not go to the temple, he is unable to see the form of the Lord. So now here Prabhupada has reversed what you've said, and he's described how now, of course, when we're talking here about these yogis, if they're accustomed to, he's talking about yogis who are accustomed to meditate upon the form of the Lord. Whether they're meditating upon the form of the Lord in the temple, so the deity, or as the super soul, but there is an advantage, there is a symptom of advancement that they have for people who, if they don't go to the temple, they're not thinking of the Lord. So, you know, there, as you can see, there are various different levels of yogis. So when we talk about yogis, we have to be careful not to lump them all on the one platform. So there are some yogis who are not accustomed to meditate upon the form of the Lord. They're the ones mentioned in the second canto. And devotees who are meditating upon the deity would be more, you know, that they're more advanced. Then, of those devotees who come and look at the form of the deities, there may be some yogis more advanced than them who can meditate upon the form of the Lord even when they're not in the temple. So, the Lord can bestow the blessings and transcendental pleasure upon either the visitor to the temple, the meditator yogi, or one who hears about the Lord's transcendental form from the scriptures like Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita. Yogis take advantage of the process of smaranam, whereas bhakti yogis take special advantage of the process of hearing and chanting. So, you know, the eighth question of your homework study was list reasons why the process of hearing and chanting is superior to fixing the mind on the pastimes of the Lord, and it asks you to do that from verse 19. But, you know, firstly I'll refer you to verse 26 as well, because there's some really nice points Prabhupada makes on that, you know, just that same point, comparing smaranam with hearing and chanting. So generally bhakti yogis particularly take advantage of hearing and chanting, and the yogis take advantage more so of smaranam. Now, question 9 is an interesting one. Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Just going one step backwards.
Yeah.
You know, you said hearing, some yogis follow hearing and chanting, right?
So, say that again.
Bhakti yogis follow hearing and chanting, right?
Yes.
And what is the other one you said? Smaranam?
Yes, remembering. Meditating.
Who's that? Who's
the yogis? the stangi yogis.
Yeah, but how can they have smarana without chanting and hearing? You know? Because it's a third step in the devotional service, right?
Therefore, it's more difficult. That's the point. That you know, our remembrance is supported by hearing and chanting. They're trying to come to the platform of remembrance without that support, and that's what makes it difficult.
Kapila, they say somewhere else that they also have to hear and chant.
They do.
Even when performing the yoga practice.
That's right, but they don't take advantage of it to the degree that the bhakti yogis do. That's, but the more they would take advantage of that, the more the you know remembrance and meditation is supported. It's practically not possible for the yogis. I think we get to that in here. It's not practically not possible for them to properly meditate. To come to the smarana without hearing and chanting, but you know they particularly take advantage of the smarana. They have, you know, they're advised as described. They're advised to take advantage of the hearing and chanting, but they don't seem to take advantage of it as much as what they probably should.
Perhaps they want to jump or something.
No, well, you know, there are different degrees of impersonalism. You know, the more we're covered by the material energy, it means the more we have an impersonal conception of life. You know, the very beginning of material life is impersonalism. That there is a sense of I want to forget you, I want to forget Krishna. That's impersonal. Yeah. That's the very beginning of material life is we become impersonal towards Krishna. I don't want to think. So therefore, you know, to the degree that we become covered by the material energy, to that degree impersonalism is there, and therefore we take things like talking, speaking, especially about persons, as something material. We're trying to, they have a material and personal understanding of that, so that they want to there's an aversion to that sort of activity, to hearing and chanting. Even there's an aversion to meditating upon the form of the Lord. And although many yogis meditate upon the form of the Lord, at some stage they give up the form of the Lord. And that's what is described in the next few verses. So therefore, it asks the question, analyze the difference between Nirbija and Sabija Yoga. Question 9, and it's asked about verse 34. Now,
Prabhu, but the yogi is, the form of the Lord isn't it's a Paramatma form, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or impersonal.
It's the Paramatma form that's being described here by Lord Kapila.
Well, are they also impersonal yogi?
Well, this is what we're about to discuss. You know, what is their understanding of Paramatma? Some of them actually, after meditating upon the Paramatma form, reject that form as some material, because they think it's part of the impersonal material energy. So, for instance, the clothes that I'm wearing, that's the impersonal. That's not me, it's a covering of me, you know, so I'm the person and the clothes are impersonal. Everything in the material world is not the supreme, but the covering, so it's impersonal. So they take, you know, the hearing, the chanting, the form, they take all those as part of the material covering, as impersonal. and they don't recognize that you know, the personal aspect of the Lord can be spiritual. They take anything that has personality, form, and qualities and what have you as part of the Maya, you know, and they take it as ultimately as impersonal, and that it only appears to be personal because of illusion. So we're going to discuss that, you know, that
again in the second canto, and like even Kapila Dev says clearly that the purpose of yoga is to end in love of God. I think in this chapter itself he says love of God, and it's also the bhakti process which enables such a yogi to progress in his meditation. So if a yogi has such an impersonal deceit perception, can we say we're not following the process properly?
Yes. Yeah. Therefore, ultimately, they give it up. Instead of attaining the ultimate goal and perfection, they give it up. And that's what's being described. In verse 34, it asks you, what is the difference between Nirvija and Sabija Yoga? Now, Prabhupada mentions in the purport here that the mind is used to purify the senses, but when the senses are purified by meditation, there is no need to sit in a particular place and try to meditate upon the form of the Lord. One becomes so habituated that he automatically engages in the personal service of the Lord. Right, so this is Stangi Yoga with bhakti should habituate a person to engage in the service of the Lord. Now, when the mind forcibly is engaged upon the form of the Lord, this is called Nirbija Yoga or lifeless yoga. For the yogi does not automatically engage in the personal service of the Lord. But when he is constantly thinking of the Lord, that is called Sabija Yoga or living yoga. One has to be promoted to the platform of living yoga. So there are two different yogis performing this process so far. There are the Nirbija Yogis and the Sabija Yogis. Those with bhakti are the Sabija Yogis. They're accepting the form of the Lord is spiritual, the hearing and chanting is spiritual, and the Nirbija Yogis, it is lifeless yoga. They're not accepting it as transcendental.
It's just out of force that you take it for granted.
Let's just discuss a little bit more and then we'll take a few questions.
When we're chanting, we're engaging our mind forcefully in trying to hear the holy name. It's not.
Now that's a different thing. So let's discuss these two different types of yogis, and then we'll take some questions. Now, see, following this course that Kapila Dev has given, the yogi gradually develops pure love for the Supreme Lord Hari. Now that's living yoga. Therefore, the hairs on his body stand erect through excessive joy. He's constantly bathing in a stream of tears, etc. Now, Prabhupada makes this statement. Gradually, even the mind which he used as a means to attract the Lord, as one attracts a fish to a hook, withdraws from material activity. Now, this is a very interesting statement by Prabhupada because in essence, he's summing up this is quite an important verse that the Acharyas comment upon quite extensively. Now, in the statement of Prabhupada, he's literally describing two yogis in one sentence. The bhakti yogi is performing the stanga yoga, mixed with bhakti, is hearing and chanting and meditating upon the Lord. He comes to develop ecstatic joy and love and attachment to the Lord. Therefore, his mind withdraws from material activity. The other yogi doesn't have that bhakti, and he's seeing the form of the Lord, and the hearing and chanting is material, and he withdraws his mind from that as if it's material. And that's all described in that one sentence there by Śrīla Prabhupāda.
Prabhupada says that he uses his mind to attract the form of the Lord, not that he avoids them.
Yes, even the mind which he used as a means to attract the Lord, as one attracts a fish to a hook. Now, a lot of understanding this example is very important to understand the two different types of yogas. Right. So let's have a look at that. See, in his commentary, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur takes this example that his heart is like a hook. See, when you compare someone's heart, imagine in the marriage vows, you are so wonderful. Your heart is like a hook. It sort of sends a bit of a connotation of something a bit hard and painful, doesn't it? You've captured my heart like a hook has captured a fish. Ooh, it sounds a bit painful and hard. That's the yogi who literally their heart is hard, and they've hurt the Lord by their considering his the hearing and the chanting and his form to be material. It's not pleasing to them. So.
But then how does the Lord appear to them at all? Because we need bhakti to be able to, even a little bit of bhakti, you need ashtanga yoga to be bhakti to be able to see the form of the Lord.
Well, they're meditating upon the Lord. They're meditating upon the Lord according to the descriptions of these things are explained. From this point to the end of the chapter, it will discuss this point. These points. He doesn't actually attain realization of the Paramatma. In other words, he's meditating upon the descriptions he has heard in scripture. This is why yogis have to hear scripture. They have to hear and chant about scripture. Otherwise, someone says meditate upon the form of the Lord. Well, they have to hear what it is, so then it's described in the scriptures. What are the forms of the Lord? You can read it. You hear it, and then you meditate upon it. But they give it up, and therefore they don't come to Paramatma realization. They will attain liberation as a result of their yoga, and even though they've rejected the transcendental form of the Lord and his pastimes as material, because they've engaged in yoga and meditated upon the Lord to some degree, they will achieve liberation from material entanglement. But only the bhakti, the ones who maintain the bhakti, accepting the Lord's form as transcendental, only those ones will actually attain realization of the Paramatma properly. How can one realize Paramatma if they've rejected it as material? How can you say that they realize Paramatma? Possible. Now, you know, a hook is generally made of iron. So, you know, the yogi's heart is somewhat like a hook. Gold melts, you know, the heart of a devotee, it melts like gold. We use the analogy in the chapter. Back in what verse was that? Gold melts. Where was that? Verse number 10. The yogis who practice such breathing exercises are very soon freed from all material disturbances, just as gold when put into fire and fanned with air becomes free from all impurities. In one sense, you can compare the bhaktis to that gold melting. But iron doesn't melt. Iron is a lot harder. It doesn't melt so easily. Gold, if you apply a little heat and it melts. So to the degree the bhakti is there, you know, it is better. The other analogy of the hook is that with a hook you disguise it. You know, you put some bait and you disguise it to make it appear to be something different. So in one sense the yogi, you know, there's a disguise of devotion or affection to the form of the Lord and what have you, but really it is just a disguise or it's a show. So is mentioned, you know, just of interest that, you know, when in the Bhagavad Gita where it mentions the yogis who gradually come to bhakti, that's not what's being referred to here. Those yogis mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, are those who, you know, properly taking the step by step and gradually come to bhakti. Here is describing that some of the yogis actually withdraw their mind from the form of the Lord and the topics of the Lord. We see in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the second canto, the third chapter, text number 24, certainly that heart is still framed, which in spite of one's chanting the holy name of the Lord with concentration, does not change when ecstasy takes place, tears fill the eyes and the hair stand on end. Even, you know, the yogis, some of them, the impersonalists, deriving some blissful, ecstatic symptoms and joyousness, still they will withdraw their mind from the form of the Lord, you know, as being in person, material. That's because their heart is still frame, you know, so that's mentioned in the Bhagavatam previously. And in that verse, back in the second canto, Vishwanath Chakravarti the core uses this verse here to confirm that type of yogi is being mentioned back there. So here, you know, two yogis are literally being described, and therefore Prabhupada is mentioning Nirbija Yoga and Sabija Yoga. He's, you know, there's two different things that are being described here. One is the lifeless yoga, which means there's no bhakti, there's a show of it. But the other one is Sabija Yoga, which means that, you know, it is living yoga, that someone is actually constantly thinking of the Lord. Constantly thinking of the Lord means Prabhupada is saying they're not going to withdraw their mind. Someone who withdraws their mind from the Lord, they're not constantly thinking of the Lord. That's the Nirbija Yoga. One who never withdraws their mind from thinking of the Lord, that's Sabija Yoga. And that means there must be bhakti, otherwise there's no bhakti. You know, if there is some, because we are talking about those who are practicing Astanga Yoga and gradually become more and more involved in Bhakti Yoga, certainly there must be some hardness of the heart that one is not just doing Bhakti altogether. And gradually that, you know, whatever hardness of the heart is there, you know, one gives that up, just like, you know, one attracts a fish to a hook. So there may be some hardness there, but, you know, gradually one becomes more involved in Bhakti Yoga. He gives up that method of attracting the Lord. He gives up whatever hardness of the heart is there, he gives that up. So you can take the verse and refer it to both types of yoga. Any questions or comments? Okay.
Can number for
second candle, verse? 2, 3, 34.
Mother Devamurti asked Kapila Dev for the practical way of performing devotional service.
Yes.
So then why does he begin to describe Ashtanga Yoga? Because that certainly doesn't seem to be practical.
Yes, because these are different steps that if one is unable to take directly to bhakti by just taking the other way to the top, one will take step by step. So I'm describing step by step. Why wouldn't one take the other way to the top? Because they don't think bhakti is the top. They don't think bhakti is the top, and that you know, hearing, chanting about the Lord is the top, then they have to take step by step, and gradually they say, oh, it was the top. Otherwise you just go straight there. So this is described. And therefore, the other thing is that by describing it, we see how bhakti is the perfection of yoga. The perfection of, you know, the king of knowledge, and the perfection of yoga. path of attention.
Prabhu.
Few books.
Prabhu, in Ashtanga Yoga,
yes.
They are not meditating on the actual form of, trying to meditate on the actual Paramatma form of the law,
yes.
But as imaginary form, then it is not yoga at all, because yoga is the connection with the law. In Ashtanga Yoga,
yes.
If they are not meditating on the Paramatma form of the law, but on the imaginary form, then that's not yoga at all, because yoga is
connected
with the Lord.
That's right, but Kapila is saying that they do meditate on the form of the Lord. No, if they take the descriptions of the form of the Lord from Shastra, it's not imaginary. Because you can create 8 types of deities. One of those deities is a mental deity. It is just transcendental and complete and absolute as the deity in the temple or as the Lord in Vrindavan. So it's not a magic, it is a deity of the Lord that they manifest within the mind.
So that is the king of the Lord is form as material. You're talking about that aspect of it.
Even then, they're not. They're thinking of the actual form of the Lord, but they're considering it to be material. So, you know, for instance, it's like saying if someone, we tell them that Krishna appeared 5,000 years ago as a cowherd boy, and so they hear that, they hear about the actual form of Krishna, and they consider he's imaginary, he didn't exist. So it means that they heard about the actual form of the Lord, but they don't accept it. Which is different from hearing about a form of the Lord that didn't exist. You know, in other words, we say that, you know, God appeared 2,000 years ago, he was a golden, oblong, glowing light.
If they don't accept it, then are they also called yogis? Because
yes, there's some benefit. They attain liberation. They don't attain full paramatma realization, but they do attain full liberation.
That's good.
And that's because they meditate upon the actual form of the Lord. But they then reject that.
So they attend the impersonal liberation.
Yes. But they get some benefit because they meditate upon the actual form of the Lord.
No, I understand. You said they meditate on the form of the Lord and then reject it.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Then they ultimately consider that meditating upon the form of the Lord was a stepping stone for meditating upon the impersonal Brahman.
But that's
not Ashtanga Yoga, that's Jnana. No, they're practicing Ashtanga Yoga, the Eightfold Yogi System. But ultimately, you know, they want liberation from material existence. And they consider that liberation to be merging into the, you know, personal Brahman.
Okay.
So, you know, jnanis can then, jnanis can then take to Ashtanga Yoga to literally attain the liberation that they've been contemplating as a jnani.
How do they figure for you that the Lord's form helps them be elevated if the Lord's form is material? Because that's what they do it for, right?
Well, because they feel that by meditating upon the form of the Lord, it has helped them to control their mind and senses and withdraw their mind and senses from all other material objects. the lower modes of material nature, and that perhaps the form of the Lord is meditating at least upon, the meditation is at least in sattva-guna or in a higher mode of material nature, and then ultimately they can give up even sattva-guna meditation.
So this is something to meditate on.
Yeah, something to meditate upon, but it's better than meditating upon the lower modes of material nature. So they may consider it to be an elevated position. You know, they may consider Vishnu to be of the material mode of sattva-guna.
On this point of liberation for yogis, in the Gita, Krishna says that only those who surrender to me can cross beyond Maya. So is this form of liberation enduring, or is it, how is it different?
No, it's not enduring. Yeah, the fact is that they they meditated, they accepted the form of the Lord for some time, and then they rejected. Therefore, there is some purification. They've approached the Lord to some degree. They haven't rejected it outright from the very beginning, that no, I will not meditate upon the form of Vishnu. They haven't said no, there's no way. That's when you get to the demons or the atheistic. You know, they've accepted that yes, I will meditate upon the form of the Lord. That is some form of approaching the Lord to some degree, and therefore they get some benefits. They get the liberation. Therefore, Krishna says that as they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. So, there is a degree of they've approached him to something. They're not persons who say no. I out and out refuse to meditate upon the form of the Lord. Or to think about the form of the Lord, or to consider it to be beautiful or attractive or wonderful in any way. There are atheistic persons who just, the thought of the form of the Lord makes them angry. So, they're not like that, they're not in that category, and therefore they've got some benefit. There are some yogis who, in Kali Yuga, as we say, most of the yogis never meditate upon the form of the Lord ever, so they won't even attain liberation. Many of them will take birth in whole species of life, worms and stool. There's some benefit.
So the strong yogis, but even if they attain liberation, but if they are the impersonal, won't they fall down? They can fall.
And then because in personal liberation, ultimately you can't, you have to fall down. Therefore, in that sense, unless they surrender to Krishna, ultimately they end up back in the material energy.
And the jnanis also get the same thing.
Unless one comes to be fixed at the lotus feet of the Lord through bhakti, then ultimately the liberation is not secure.
Yeah, so basically it's if you're a Ashtanga yogi or a jnana yogi, just still step lower, but you will still get the same result.
You can, they can. Sometimes the Jnana yogis and the Ashtanga yogis can attain the personal liberation.
Generally, they say that Brahmavadis can attain liberation, but Mayavadis can't. So if you're saying that they think that the form of the Lord is material, isn't that Mayavadi? Whereas if they think that the form of the Lord is spiritual, then beyond the form of the Lord there is something else.
Yeah, well, it's it's very similar. Mayavadis, they literally you know, strongly propagate the conception and the philosophy that form and qualities of the world material. Impersonalists tend to be just, you know, more almost, you know, there's somewhat innocence in one sense that, you know, in impersonalists, therefore, many of these yogis are to some degree impersonalists, and that's why Kapila Muni is getting them to study Sankhya philosophy as impersonalists like to do, and Astanga yoga as impersonalists may like to do, with some bhakti. And gradually the bhakti portion of it, they become more and more attracted to. So that, you know, for impersonalists that are somewhat innocent, they're impersonalists, gradually as they perform jnana yoga, sankhya yoga, the bhakti will attract them. The mayavadis will not be attracted. See, because they're not so much innocent in the sense that, you know, they're determined to, not accept bhakti and you know, that the personal conception of the Lord at all, ever, at any stage, you know, as anything but, you know, their mind is not so open as like an innocent impersonalist. An impersonalist can actually just be coming, you know, as you said, the very beginning of material existence is impersonalism. That we say to Krishna, you know, I want to forget you. That's impersonalism. So everyone in the material world is an impersonalist to one degree or another, because we've all said to Krishna, I want to forget you as a person. Right? That's impersonalism. And the material energy allows us to be impersonalists. Taking a step-by-step process of purification, we can come back to where the soul, the natural purified, that love of God or that personalism is latent within the heart. By purification, again, we become personalists. So, but the mayavadis are a different category in that, you know, they won't take that step-by-step process. You know, they're fixed in one particular spot of impersonalism without any, you know, ability to sort of, you know, they're just entrenched, you know, in the understanding of impersonalism. They're determined, very, very determined impersonalists. You know. So they're not so much impersonalists moving along in this innocence, in aesthetic places, the persons who are determinedly fixed in a certain position of that.
I was just saying, because you said that they reject the form as material.
Yes.
So generally that's what we say a Mayavadi thinks, that the Lord's form is in the mode of goodness.
Yes.
Right, so Brahmavadi accepts that the Lord's form is spiritual, but they think that beyond the Lord's form is something else.
They're both accepting ultimately that you know, the absolute truth is impersonal. The Mayavadis and the impersonalists, the Brahmavadis and the Mayavadis are accepting that the absolute truth is impersonal. They're both accepting that. The difference is that the impersonalists, you know, they're gradually moving forward, you know, a little bit more innocently, and by purification, as personalism becomes more attractive and more understood, they accept it. But a Mayavadi won't. But certainly impersonalists speak a lot of Ayurvedic philosophy. You know, impersonalists speak a lot of Ayurvedic philosophy, but they're still progressively moving forward if the opportunity is there. Determined by Ayurvedic one. So let's look at the last verses in this chapter.
Like the four Kumaras,
they're
moving
forward. Yeah.
And they became a devotee.
They became a devotee. And had they not committed an offense, they would have been elevated beyond Santaras to Dasyaras.
Offense of
Jain. Yeah. So they became devotees. Because of the aparad, they were checked at Santaras. Otherwise, they actually would have been awarded Dasyaras. That offense had been committed. By associating with the Lord, as they did, they should have been awarded Dasyaras. But the offense checked them. Santaras.
So then,
and that shows you how no matter how elevated one may be as a devotee, be very careful about committing offense.
But we were discussing that day.
Sometimes we see in our movement that sometimes people think because I'm a big devotee that I can commit offense to others. But we see here with the Kumaras, even in the association of the Lord, and even as exalted as they were, an offense to a Vaishnava will have an effect. And therefore, you know, it doesn't matter whether people in our movement, people can become TPs, GVCs, sannyasis, or what have you, it does not make them gurus or anything. It does not make them above aparad. Sometimes actually some devotees can think like that, that I've been around for so long, okay, I commit Vaishnava aparad, but my position is not going to affect at any position. That's the point. At any, even you, one of the Kumaras, you personally visit Jain, the Lord in Vaikuntha, aparad will have an effect.
But all the same, it was still the whole thing was ordained by the Lord as well. That's another argument.
Yeah, that's a different point.
No, we discussed this, that actually they were exalted in that they wanted to satisfy the desire of the Lord to fight. That's why they did it.
Jaya Vijaya.
Yes. Okay, you're talking about Kumaras.
The Kumaras created an offense in aparad, and therefore the Premier was checked at a
certain point. So how serious are they in terms of the gravity of the offense, the degree of the offense, how it actually works in terms of whether or not it completely fall down or will have a more lesser serious reaction? How does that work?
Yeah, that verse in the Bhagavad Gita, as they surrender unto me, I will walk forth accordingly. Krishna reciprocates with every devotional thought or every offensive thought both to Krishna and his devotees. And as we know, those towards devotees are particularly potent. And therefore we see that in the Krishna book, if you look at all the different demons who, you know, were killed by the Lord, and also then going back through the various incarnations, some of those demons appeared in different a few times, that they, when they were killed by the Lord, they didn't all just immediately get the same effect. They each got different effects. So sometimes when they were killed by the Lord performed the funeral ceremony for, you know, the demon's family. Sometimes they got a personal liberation. Sometimes they got liberation where they didn't get they didn't get liberation. They become very wealthy in the next life, and that is because Sanatana Goswami has analysed the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Every action those demons performed, and the thoughts that some accepted his form, some accepted his form as beautiful, some, you know, for every slight step of devotional thought or action or offensive action or what have you, it was accommodated in the result that they got. So it's not as if they're all just, you know, Krishna just, you know, gave more a variety of different results just to be different, but exactly according to how they reciprocated with Krishna, even as demons, they got a particular type of result after being killed by the Lord. And you know, devotees also, that according to their devotion, you know, Krishna takes into consideration their devotional activities, and then there's their aparas and what have you like that. There's usually the aparas which cling on and check us more than any other thing in devotional service. So Krishna is accommodating each and everything that we do. So in other words, we ask, you know, how does it affect? If we do something very severe, aparad, we get checked more forcefully. He will proportionally check us in our progress or in our advancement. You know, if the aparads are less serious, it means that, you know, the checking is very slight, which means that we come to the platform of prema bhakti more readily, very close to the Lord. The ultimate thing is that if we consider, do I have prema bhakti? And we know from the verse in the Bhagavatam 2.3.34 that from Lord Chaitanya's statement that if we're not have attraction for chanting the holy names and developing ecstatic symptoms, it's because of offences. So everything is exactly proportioned. So the same with these yogis, you know. Here, these yogis, some of them will take Lord Kapila's instructions on Astanga Yoga and follow it to a certain limit, they will get the result apportioned to them to the degree that they follow that process. And then those who withdraw their mind at a certain point, they will get some result for what they have done positively and to the point where they've actually, you know, maintain an offensive mentality in one sense, then they will be checked at that point. And therefore, we see that some of the yogis will not get paramattha realization, and some of them will. And that's what's described in the last part of the chapter.
But those who actually get paramattha realization, but not Bhagavan realization, so what happens to them?
Yes, that means they've been checked, they get checked at a certain level. They don't come to Bhagavan realization, and they're following this path as mentioned by the Kapila. They should come to Bhagavan realization. If they don't, then it means that there is they will be checked because their bhakti, which is how they're loving Krishna, reciprocate is they check their bhakti at a certain point, so Krishna checks their progress at that point. Unless one comes to pure devotional service, one cannot really, you know, come to proper Bhagavan realization. So that's another beauty of why, you know, the beauty of, we may say, because sometimes, you know, even devotees think, you know, why read Lord Kapila's, you know, philosophy? Because, you know, we're bhakti yogis, you know, why are we even, you know, going this jnana, you know, and yoga, you know, like, you know, let's just get to the bhakti part of the Bhagavad Gita. You know, that's a complete nonsense, but actually even some devotees think like that. But by going through this, you know, we can actually see at each step what a tinge of bhakti would award and what a full measure of bhakti would award, you know, as we go through Lord Kapila's. So here in this chapter we're seeing that these yogis have some bhakti. Some are getting checked at impersonal liberation, those with a little bit more bhakti are getting paramattva realization. So we're seeing bhakti, you know, is always awarding results, and therefore we're actually studying bhakti. Because in one sense we're seeing that these processes of yoga and the processes of Sankhya and Stangya are only giving results because of the bhakti associated with them. So, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam is a study of bhakti. These chapters get very, very technical, and, you know, sometimes Sankhya, sometimes Stangya. But what we're seeing is, you know, bhakti. That's the main thing. And then in the next chapter, we will see how, you know, it talks about the modes of material nature, but what we're discussing bhakti again. But bhakti, you know, when it's performed by a performer who's influenced by different degrees of tamas, rajas, and sattva, will give a different effect.
So going back to the Kumaras, is it? Just missed that point. So who was left at Santarasa? Was it the Kumaras?
The Kumaras.
Because of
their offence.
Their offence to Jaya Vijaya. Yes. So they were just checked there, they were just at Santarasa, they couldn't go ahead.
That's right.
So that's
where
they are asking forgiveness from the Lord, because we don't know what we have done. Forgive us. I mean, Lord being the father of the saint. I mean, if you have guided them, okay, that's not the way to insult us. Why did he
just leave
them there?
He gave them good instruction.
No, then after that, the Kumaras too
realized
that maybe they have done some offense, actually, they have done the wrong thing.
Oh, they didn't. No,
the Jaya
and Vijaya.
Kumaras, they said that maybe what we have done is wrong.
Yes, because they had committed some of
that. The way the Lord talked,
yeah.
They were confused and they said maybe we were hasty and we were too hasty to
search
those things. So they were repentant.
Yes.
You do, Lord, you do whatever you want. You can take away the curse if you want to.
Yes.
And they were repentant. They were feeling bad. Still, why did the Lord forgive them and allow them to progress? Why didn't he just check this?
The Kumaras. Why did he forgive them?
Why he didn't take them at that level?
Oh, why? Yeah.
And he not forgive them for the offense that they
had done. Yeah, he did. There's forgiveness plus checking.
No, but then he's checked them. Then he said they can't progress beyond that level.
Yes, but he's given them, you know, he's given them a wonderful result, even though they've done, you know, some big mistake. They've been very well rewarded, even though the mistake was quite considerable. But
for their devotion, they've been checked at that level. They've not been allowed to go for.
That's right.
No, that's what I'm saying. Those the Lord has checked them at that level.
Yeah. He has
not allowed them to go ahead.
No.
But that's a huge punishment too.
It is. Therefore, we have to be careful of Vaishnava apparatus.
But then why has Lord done it?
There were.
They
were impersonals before and they came.
They got a huge benefit from the Lord.
They were impersonals.
They were changed from impersonals to devotees. So, you know, they came out of it pretty well. They landed on their feet. They would have come out a little bit better had the offense not been there.
God forgave them, and they got a lot of benefits. But God can't instill, like, pure devotion service, and something like that. They can't, if you don't believe in the rasa, they were situated in a particular rasa to God by even forgiving them, and blessing them, to increase their rasa. That's something that has to come from their side, isn't it? Whether you're in rasa era, so satya era, so that has to come from their end, isn't it? So they actually got more than what they deserve because they rest.
Well, they, you know, because, see, for many of the acharyas, in one sense, Santa Rasa at a certain level is rejected or is just like borderline. So for many it's sort of unacceptable, but still it's better than being in person, unless you're on the threshold. So
they actually pray. It doesn't matter, we understand we've done something wrong, it doesn't matter if you go to hell or heaven, please let us pray to get the Lord.
Well, yeah, the thing is that the Lord, he has to, for instance, you literally have to question every decision the Lord's made, because you know, what he does is that as you he says, as you surrender unto me, I reward you accordingly. So, therefore, he shows his extreme mercy by rewarding. When the Lord rewards one, someone has done something very little, but the Lord rewards one unlimitedly. The commanders were rewarded unlimitedly. They have nothing to But to the point that they surrendered, then, you know, that is also considered, and therefore, because there was some offence, then that's considered. That the surrender or the reciprocation to the Lord stopped at a certain point. So, you know, the Lord reciprocated with them unlimitedly, he rewarded them unlimitedly. I don't, you know, no one should ever complain that the Lord didn't give them enough. You know, when is unlimited reward not enough? But at the same time, you know, they were given a bit of a pinch by the Lord, you know, a bit of checking that if they want more from the Lord, as far as to take up Dasya Rasya, they have to be prepared to have more respect for the devotees of the Lord, the associates of the Lord, more than what they had. And that's, you know, so for in giving that instruction, it's his great mercy to them and to the whole world. So, you know, we all know now that no matter how, even if one is practically a liberated person, if one doesn't have a, you know, sufficient quantity of respect for the devotees of the Lord, that person can never attain Prema Bhakti simply by their transcendental position, or by their yogic abilities, or by their transcendental knowledge, or by their mystic cities, or anything. So, you know, it's a wonderful lesson for all of us.
So such persons have to atone for their offence, and then they could just never attain at all.
Yeah, otherwise what happens if the Lord says, oh, he's done this because I'm so merciful, I'll let him get away with it. And Basically, everybody's doing all sorts of things that they should, but I'm so merciful, I'm just going to let everybody get away with everything, because that's happened. So how would we ever learn anything? Because we would say, oh, you know, I think I'll go out and kill someone, because I know the Lord's so merciful, he just forgives everything. And, you know, I'll let the body talk by, you know, before, or I'm going to bash him. You know, the Lord's so merciful, he'll forgive that, and I'll still, you know.
No, but that is,
No, but that's...
doing an act, even if you charge with an intention that, oh Lord, please be forgiven, that is an offense.
Yeah.
That's a different thing.
No, but actually it's stated in the Bhagavad Gita that even when the Lord forgives a person, the dust of the lotus feet of the devotee still acts. So even the Lord completely forgives a person, but the dust of the feet of the devotee is so potent that it will act against the offender. And the Lord's forgiven that person. That's, therefore, the Lord, in giving stern warning, is really given very good, it's great mercy, because you know, the offense for Vaishnava is so serious. And practically, it's something that the Lord, you know, so that even he forgives, still they will get the reaction of that offense. It's such a powerful thing. So if the Lord doesn't, you know, somehow give instruction of that danger, he's doing everyone, including the Kumaras, a you know, a disfavor.
Can you say for me? If we're in a situation where we're unsure of, you know, there's maybe some misunderstanding of the way, we're unsure, you know, was this an offence? Should we consider it an offence just to be sure and pass it? Because there can be so many situations
yes, it's better to be sure that, you know, the best policy is that, you know, if we're not sure, we just, you know, go to the devotee and say, look, you know, the other day I had a few wise cracks about your Big Cat Valley or something, but, you know, did I offend you, or, you know, or, you know, we were just joking. So you can go and ask him, you know, and they say, look, you know, I was a bit, you know, peaky when you said that. Yeah, you might say, oh, look, I'm sorry, is there anything I can do, you know, you should offer them some nice words and see if you can make it up to them and patch up that, you know, and apologise and what have you. You know, it doesn't hurt to, you know, be, it's actually a better policy to go and just ask, and look, you know, I'm not sure, but did I cause an offence the other day, such and such. That's how it's always been policy. And then, you know, if they're, you know, that very act itself is usually quite satisfying to the devotees, and they will, you know, usually the fact that you've approached them, they'll, you know, if there was some disturbance, they become very, very, disinclined to hold any, you know, grudges. Something we certainly have to be very careful of as well. I mean, you know, my personal experience is that I've seen devotees who, you know, within our movement, who cruise along doing all sorts of services. Some of them who can barely follow the regular principles and get up to even various types of sinful activities. But their ability to maintain nice relationships with devotees, and they just go for even many, many years. And yet, those same persons or others who are very strict in the regular principles and the devotional habits, when they become offensive devotees, well, you see their devotional service can just, you know, fall apart. And somehow or another, you know, if they maintain that for some time, you know, they fail to be able to do devotional service after some time. You know, very quickly it takes effort. That's what I personally say.
What kind of offenses?
Quite often it's when they get a particular, to say, bee in their bonnet against a particular devotee. Mm. You know, that therefore they say bad things about that. They try to give that devotee a bad name. They try to disrupt that devotee's service. They have a threatening or angry disposition in the presence of that devotee. So quite often it's when especially particular devotees become almost a target for their anger or envy over a sustained view.
Okay, so it's for those kind of offences that we that may be.
Yeah, you know, the odd offence apparat that devotees commit, you know, usually if it's accidental and it's not a sustained, you know, something against a particular person, it's like some mistake in the thing they didn't understand, they do something a bit silly which was offensive, that's not as dangerous, although one has to be careful. But usually when there's some sustained problem against some particular devotee, even that devotee actually has so many faults, that doesn't matter, that doesn't come into it. Actually Haridas Thakura explains that in the Harinam Chintamani, that one may think, well, that devotee has so many faults, and therefore, okay, I'm being a bit offensive, but they've got so much fault, so it's not, you know, the offence is not going to have such a reaction because they've got so many faults. And he explains in a very nice way that is ludicrous. And despite their faults, that offence will act just the same. And that quite often tricks people. They think, oh, okay, I'm being offensive, but look at that person, you know. It's like, God, you know, that person has got so many faults, you know. And Haridas Thakura, Bhaktivinoda Thakura, that book, it very nicely describes it. Those apparatus have just the same effect as any other Vaishnava in that person as well.
And this goes to all levels of devotees.
Yes, it doesn't matter. That's the thing with the Kumaras. You know, they were great transcendental liberated yogis who were in the presence of the Lord Himself. But the offense still, it had an effect.
Yeah, but I mean, this is, I'm talking to the devotee who is offended, even if he is, let's say, not a very high level supporter.
Yes, but how do we know he's not a high level devotee?
I don't know.
So, you know, for instance, you know, the green mango is a mango nonetheless. In time it'll ripen. Or is that, you know, there's a ripe mango, we'll treat that one carefully, here's a green one, I'll smash it against the wall. Why'd you waste that mango? I was green, but it'll ripe. Okay. So, verse 19, we describe that one is meditating upon the Lord, sitting and standing and laying down, what have you. So, different types of devotees may meditate upon the Lord, either in Vaidhi Bhakti or Raghunuga Bhakti. Some will meditate upon the Lord in Vaikuntha at the base of the desire tree in Vrindavan. So here, Lord Kapila is meditating upon, describing the meditation upon Lord Vishnu. But of course, that doesn't mean that bhakti yogis would not take the same instruction. You know, we also meditate upon the form of the Lord. Yeah. We meditate upon the deity of the Lord, but we can meditate upon the deity of the Lord in Vrindavan, more so than Vishnu situated in the heart. The same process. Sometimes he sits on a dual throne. Sometimes we see Krishna laying on the bed of Anantasesha. When the Kura went to the took Balaram and Krishna to the bathing ghat. And then he saw Krishna Balaram, Balaram took the form of Sesha, Krishna. So, you can meditate upon, or we can meditate upon Lakshmi massaging the lotus feet of Vishnu or Narayan, as he's on the city. So, and of course, in this way, there are different activities that the Lord is performing. So when we say pastimes, even the yogis, meditating upon the pastimes of the Lord, and meditating upon, Lakshmi massaging the lotus feet of the Lord, or sometimes he's doing this or doing that. So for us, we can actually take the same instructions and be meditating upon Krishna. Similar way, the way we read Srimad Bhagavatam, we start from the lotus feet and gradually we go to the gradually to the face, the spinal trace, which is the 10th canto. So it's exactly the same instruction. Meditate upon the Lord sitting. The Lord sometimes rode on the shoulders of Garuda. That's another way of meditating upon the Lord sitting. Imagination, the purport, verse 21, it says, Mayavadi says, because one is unable to fix his mind on the impersonal existence of the absolute truth, one can imagine any form he likes and fix his mind on that. So of course they imagine that God has, everything is one, so Kali is this God. So that's imagination. Prabhupada says, imagination is always imagination and results only in further imagination. So, So that's different to, you know, that's the Maya values. Verse 36, Prabhupada describes that when the devotee's mind is purified and he understands that his mind has to be dovetailed with the desires of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he has attained the perfection of the transcendental stage, which is beyond the perception of material distress and happiness. As long as one acts on his own account, he is subject to all the material perceptions of so-called happiness and distress. So the mind becomes one with the Supreme Lord, one in desires. Now, that realized soul has no conception of how the material body is moving or acting, just as an intoxicated person cannot understand whether or not he has clothing on his body. So he forgets his material bodily demands. So these verses are describing the Jiva Mukta. One is liberated even while he's within this body. So, you know, not being aware of his body, there's no question of happiness and distress. Prabhupada mentions in verse 38, the body of such a liberated yogi, along with the senses, is taken charge of by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and it functions until its destined activities are finished. You know, that liberated yogi is in samadhi. You know, such a person is considering their bodily activities to be like a dream. So, Prabhupada mentions in the purport, that body is taken charge of by the Supreme Lord. It's not acting due to the living force of the living entity. It's simply acting as a reaction to past activities. Very interesting point there. And this is the example of the, you know, even after being switched off, an electric fan moves for some time. So, you know, a liberated person, the body is continuing as a result of the actions of their past, you know, activities. It's a continuation of their past activities, has a momentum, and so the body keeps going until its destined time is allotted. But actually, they're no longer, you know, identifying or literally taking charge of the body. You know, just like you know, you have a fan, you take charge, but you turn the electricity on, and you know, you're making sure the fan's going round. And then you decide, no, I'm finished with that, and you turn it off. So you no longer, you know, have any concern for the movement of the fan, nor are you doing anything to keep it going. But just as a result of its previous movement, it just keeps turning for a little bit. So, so the liberated person therefore describes how they accept their family. You know, we accept some children as our sons and daughters because of our affection for them, although we know very well that these children are different from us. Similarly, because of great affection for money, we accept some account, amount of wealth in the bank as ours. Similarly, we claim that the body is ours because of affection for it. So the liberated person's, you know, dealings with the body and family are completely different. So the liberated person that comes to the philosophy of Achincha Beda Tattva, everything is simultaneously one with and different from everything else, from the Lord. Now, in verse 41, there's an emphasis on the difference from the living entity, the jiva, and verse 42 emphasizes the oneness of the living entity with everything. So, you know, we see in verse 41 that the cosmic manifestation is, you know, different from the jiva and different from the Lord. The living entity is different from the material elements. The yogi, the liberated yogi, is not identifying himself with the material body. He's considering, I am different from the material elements. So this is the, you know, but he's considering that although I am different from the material elements, and as a spirit soul, I am also different from the Supreme Personality of God, the Super Soul that I'm meditating upon. At the same time, I accept that I am one with the Supreme Lord, because I am, you know, the Parapakri, the spiritual energy with the Paramatma, and therefore my desires should be dovetailed with the Lord. And so the yogi is thinking in terms of oneness and difference. Because I'm different from the body, therefore why I should identify? Because I'm different from the Lord, I should not be thinking of impersonal liberation. Because I'm one with the Lord in the sense of being, you know, a particle of the Lord's energy, I should be one with the Lord in desire. Okay. So the yogi is thinking in terms of simultaneously one and difference. That is the liberated position. And therefore the example is given of, you know, fire, flame, and smoke. You know, smoke is different from the flame. The soul is different from the body, and you know, the spark is different from the blazing fire. You know, we should see the differences, and at the same time, there is a oneness. You know,
how does the flame be different from the fire? I thought flame and fire were the same thing.
Well, one flame is not the same as the whole fire.
Okay.
There are many flames in the fire.
No, but
spark, well, a spark is just a little part of the flame. And the flame is just, you know, one arm or extension of the fire. There are many flames in the fire. You know, so we take the fire as a whole, and then we take it in various parts. There are flames, individual flames within the fire. There are sparks within the flames, there is smoke, it's the wood. And the yogi also, therefore sees the super soul within each and every living entity, that every single living being, there is a oneness, that just as I am a spirit soul, a little spiritual atom, part of the Lord's spiritual energy, every other living being is the same. They're also a spirit soul. Not that, other living beings are not spiritual, some religious movements think like that, that they think that only humans have souls and animals don't, or they think that even only some humans have souls, and until they surrender to Jesus or what, and then they'll get a soul, and before that they don't have one. But the yogi understands, no, they're all spirit souls eternally at that. So that's the proper vision. And ultimately, one also sees that Paramatma is the cause of all living beings and material existence and spiritual existence. So, although that spirit soul is the same, when it assumes different material bodies, it appears differently. Just as fire will appear differently when it comes from different wood. Essentially, the fire is the same. Similarly, the Paramatma, or the Supreme Lord, can also appear to be as many varieties, but actually the super soul is one, even though the super soul appears in many different bodies. These are the transcendental vision that the liberated person must have in order to be considered properly liberated. So in this way, the yogi, in the self-realized position after conquering the insurmountable spell of Maya, So the yogi can be in the self-realized position after conquering the insurmountable spell of Maya. Maya presents itself, of course, as both the cause and the effect. And that's, a lot of people become bewildered by that. Prabhupada quotes there, one who surrenders unto Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, can conquer the seemingly insurmountable spell of Maya. After Brahman realization, one can engage in the activities of Brahman. After realizing oneself to be Brahman, devotional service begins. For those who engage in devotional service, there is no spell of Maya, and the situation is all perfect. So, here we see the connection to, chapter 29, that in effect, Lord Kapila has described how through, Sankhya Yoga, one can analyze oneself to be different from the material elements, and how the material elements have been set in motion by the Supreme Lord, the Super Soul, and that by practicing Astanga Yoga and meditating upon that Super Soul, one can come to the liberated position beyond ignorance and become liberated from the bodily entanglement. And on that platform, one can then take up, devotional service more actively. And in chapters 29, then we hear about devotional service a little bit more. Just, described as. Explanation of devotional service, and you see in those first few verses, as we describe, that Devahuti does ask Kapila about the nature of, you know, suffering in the material world, and that is an impetus for one to, you know, take up devotional service. And then we hear about devotional service from the beginning stages, where it's strongly affected by the lower modes of material nature, gradually rising up to pure devotional service. Of course, we won't have time to do that today, but that's I was hoping to get through that today. So next week we'll have to discuss that, chapter 29.
So you're saying that he brings us, he shows us how the living entity is separate from the three modes of material nature and also from the Supreme Lord. And then in chapter 29, he explains the activity of a liberated person.
In chapter 29, he brought us to the point of where the Sangha Yogi has meditated upon the Supreme Lord in order to attain liberation, but in the course of that has actually developed transcendental joy in the by meditating upon the Lord, and that leads to bhakti, or the desire to love and serve that Lord. So how do you act upon that desire to love and serve that Lord that you meditated upon? That is described in the next chapter, devotional service. And of course he will describe devotional service ultimately. We want to hear about pure devotional service, but to understand, you know, pure devotional service, we sort of have to understand what is, you know, devotional service, which is being influenced, you know, by the modes of material nature. Now I think, just looking at our calendar, transcendental events. Next week we should be able to finish this chapter. Let's hope to finish it today. And the following week I think they have the retreat.
Yeah.
Who's going to that? So next week, so what that will do is give you what's after that. And then we have so then on the 8th of September we come back for an exam. All your essays handled in. So that gives you, you know, again, like a two week break between. So the 8th of September, put that in your diary. Exam. Next week we finish off definitely this unit. And unit 12, there's only four chapters. Sometimes we do cover one or two chapters in the lesson. So, you know, if you've got time, read that. I imagine we'll go through unit 12 quite quickly. Two or three lessons. chapter 30 to 33. Four chapters. Finishes the third canto. By rights, what did I say, the 8th of September?
Yes.
8th of September, this exam, which means that after that we will start the fourth canto. This Saturday, the 15th, will be one lesson. Saturday the 22nd. The 29th of September. And then the 6th. At the very latest, it'll be the 6th. That's one chapter per week. So on the 6th of October, which means the exam would be on October the 13th. And after that, there's a couple of big weddings, isn't it? Okay, so the marathon usually begins somewhere around about November, is that correct?
Yeah, end of November.
End of November. And is anyone going to India this year? You're going? When are you going? End of November. January?
Long way off.
Is you going?
Mid-December.
So we got some of October and November. The Simons? Okay. Well, we could do that.
Catching up exams.
Who would like to just finish up when we finish up the third canto and then leave it there, which would be somewhere around about, October? And who would like to go forward a bit more?
It's the beginning, starting fourth canto.
Fourth canto, yeah.
This year?
Yeah.
This year? When did we finish the canto?
October.
We would finish, if we started the fourth canto, it would be somewhere around about the third week of October. So towards the end of October.
How many chapters in the fourth canto do we have initially?
We won't get very far with it. You'd probably get a unit or two in. What's that?
It's
Prabhupada's disappearance on the November the 17th. So I would say that we would be, if we went further, we'd be finished up before November the 17th, which means we'd be having an exam, on Saturday, November the 10th, which I've actually got marked in my diary as what I would consider to be the last class. I was anticipating to be November the 10th. That's when I was considering. Which means that we would have... and all those Saturdays, apart from weddings that I'm doing, are free for most other people. November 10th, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4... It's about 4 weeks. You'd get one unit of Canto 4 in.
by November 10th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we finish Canto 3, if you wanted to go ahead and do start on Canto 4, you'd get one unit, which is, you know, like the first three, four chapters. Which is
good. But would we give an exam for that? Or?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would be this.
And then, yeah. The exam would be, you know, probably the week before Prabhupada's disappearance. And then that's it. Yeah. Yeah. Then that gives you know, the rest of November, which is about, you know, the best part of November, December, all of January, and we usually start somewhere around about middle of February, depending on, you know, what festivals and weddings are on and things like that. December, January, about 2.5 months, who's sort of finishing up when we finish the third canto? Right, so this would be around mid-October. Who's finishing up then?
Usually we finish up a bit later than what we think. So I'd be surprised if we could in the first minute.
Yeah,
it's because it usually pushes somehow. Like the exam for this unit was supposed to be last. No, this week.
It didn't look quite.
This week. Yeah.
Sorry.
But it's turning out to be another 3 weeks.
Oh, I've got wedding. I've got something wedding. I've got that's 8th of September. Yeah, I'll just we've got that's Krishna in DK.
Yeah.
So there's that one there, and then I've got a wedding on the 15th, which is the next week, and then on the. I've got another one on the 20th. I've got one on the 4th of October. I've got one on Saturday the 20th, and another one on the 21st of October. I mean, I've got weddings practically either every week or every second week.
Better to start the fourth canto after New Year.
Oh, it doesn't bother me.
We can finish the day. We can like the wedding.
Probably not. Usually the devotee's wedding, no. Yeah, so. When did I say the exam was?
The 8th of September.
And that's the 8th of September, and that is the wedding, is it? Yeah, because on the 1st of September is a retreat, and then the 8th is usually the devotee's wedding day if you don't do it. So that's the 8th. That would mean, you know, our next lesson for the exam would be the 15th. I mean, I have a wedding on that day, but I can still give you an exam, no problem. But yeah, that certainly does push things back, so I think it may be looking like we're going to finish the third canto and just leave there. Alright?
Is there no class on the first?
Yes, the first. No class.
No, usually when there's a devotee wedding, that's because they've got a retreat.
Yeah.
How many people are going to the retreat? I mean, I'd say. Yeah, who? Yeah,
Chandra.
A lot of people will be there, I think. Next week there's a class, or are you going to the farm? Next week.
Next week is the class, right? We're doing the last chapter.
Next week I'll be here to do the last chapter 29.
Yeah. So that will be the last class of the unit, I guess.
That'll be the last class of this unit, yep. And then we've got one unit to go, which is actually going to be quite a quick unit.
Yeah,
four chapters. The difficulty is once we finish this unit, it's going to be, we have to set a date when we come back and have the exam. It can't be on the 1st because too many people at the retreat. It can't be on the 8th because there's a wedding.
Because 15th.
So we're going to have to make the next one the 15th. That's when we have the exam.
Alright. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the following week we start the last unit of module 1, and we'll do 3 or 4 weeks, have the exam, and then we'll finish up for the year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How can we schedule to catch up on the exam that we have
yet? Yeah, well,
suppose we can